Science Talks is recorded at the Legacy Music Recording Studio in Lewisville, Texas. Ben Robertson is our sound engineer, and you've been listening to Becerro, composed by Brian Pinkelman and performed by Brian Pinkelman on piano and Logan Pinkelman on the bassoon. Welcome to Science Talks podcast, where we discuss big topics in science and speak with experts on their latest publications. Science has a general method that is used for information presentation, and on Science Talks, we will discuss one publication in the format of a typical paper, which includes an introduction, methods, results, and a discussion section. By using this method, we hope to teach the general public and scientists in training about the process of science, in addition to the content of the published paper. We hope you enjoy today's topic and invite you to subscribe to our podcast channel. Hello to everybody. My name is Dr. Deanna Soper, and I will be your host. My path to this point has not been linear. As a first-generation college student, I really thought that obtaining my bachelor's degree was a dream come true, and I did just that. In 1999, I graduated from Tryon University in Indiana with a degree in biology and science education. I moved back to my hometown to teach at my alma mater high school. But soon after I started to teach, I realized I wanted to do more. And at that time, I thought I might want to leave education for an industry job. So I obtained my master's in business administration from Indiana University Northwest in 2004. But while I was a student there, I partook in a leadership organization, and through that experience discovered that I really am a teacher at heart. And at the urging of one of my professors, I started the journey of figuring out how to obtain a PhD so that I could focus on teaching college. I found my way to Indiana University Bloomington and fell in love with the field of evolutionary ecology. I studied reproductive behavior in a tiny snail from New Zealand under the direction of Dr. Kurt Lively. I became fascinated with the evolution of reproduction in an animal that experiences at times very high levels of parasitism by a worm. I really wanted to understand how reproduction evolves when the population is at high risk of infection by the worm, which actually sterilizes it. In 2012, I graduated from Indiana University and moved back to the Chicago area, where I was a mom to my son, who was then 1 year old, and served as an adjunct instructor at two different small colleges. In 2013, I accepted a postdoctoral position at the University of Iowa with Dr. Maureen Neiman, where I continued to study the same snail species I had studied while obtaining my PhD. In 2014, I began a short-term teaching position at Beloit College, where I primarily focused on teaching. Finally, in 2016, I moved to Dallas to start a tenure-track position at the University of Dallas. I am still at the University of Dallas, where I am now a tenured professor. While my initial research focused on the evolution of reproduction in a tiny snail from New Zealand, my later work has focused on the growth of shallow water stony coral species and the biodiversity of the deep sea. I should mention that all opinions expressed here are solely mine and not reflective of the University of Dallas. On the Science Talks podcast, we will address big topics in science ranging from different scientific disciplines, including biology, chemistry, and physics. I hope to bridge the gap between the conversations that only scientists have and assist in distributing that information to a wider general audience. In the science world, the main avenue of information distribution is through something called the primary literature. These are papers that scientists write and submit for publication in peer-reviewed journals. This means that we write up our results typically in the format of an introduction, methods, results, and discussion section, and then submit the paper to the journal that we choose. There are hundreds of academic journals, but generally, they are all peer-reviewed. Once we submit the paper for publication, if the editorial staff are interested in the possibility of publishing the paper, they will identify at least two other experts in that field and send the paper to them to seek their opinion on the quality of the science, the writing, the data analysis, and the presentation of the information. Each week on Science Talks, I will feature one scientist and we will break down one of their recent publications. This week, I am hosting Dr. Amrita Bhattacharya, and her recent paper focuses on the evolution of antibiotic resistance. This is a topic everyone should be concerned about because when microbes evolve resistance to the drugs we use to fight them, we are at risk of not being able to treat bacterial infections. Dr. Bhattacharya obtained her bachelor's degree at the University of Mumbai, India in 2010. She went on to her master's degree at Tata Institute of Fundamental Research and studied behavioral neuroscience and graduated in 2013. She then moved to the United States to begin her PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology at Indiana University, where she studied under Dr. Kurt Lively and Dr. Farah Bashi-Visser, where she focused on host-parasite interactions and microbial-social interactions. She went on to a postdoctoral position at Penn State University, where she focused on pathogen evolution and worked with large data sets. In 2023, she left academia to work for Ranchero Biosciences as a data integrity expert. She has 10 published papers with over 200 citations. Please welcome to the show, Dr. Amrita Bhattacharya.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great to be here.
So my first question is, I want you to tell the story behind this paper. And the paper, by the way, is entitled Exceptions to the Rule: When Does Resistance Evolution Not Undermine Antibiotic Therapy in Human Bacterial Infections? And it was published in Evolution Letters in 2024. So it looks like on the paper that you do have your Penn State address on there. So I would assume that this paper came about while you were doing your postdoctoral research.
That's right. Yes, this was the biggest chunk of my postdoctoral research. And there is actually an interesting story as to how this came about. By training, as you mentioned, I was an experimentalist, really, and I did a little bit of theory and analysis, of course, all the analysis of the data. But I started my postdoc in 2019, and I was in the lab of David Kennedy, and we were setting up experiments when COVID hit, and we all went under lockdown. So it was very difficult for a few months for any of us to really go into lab and continue doing experimental work. So there was this idea that my advisor, I think, had been thinking about for a bit, and we had discussed a fair bit in terms of doing a review article along on the side. But then the lockdown from COVID actually became a blessing in disguise when we really got to kind of delve into the question at hand. And as I'll discuss probably as we go along with how the paper came to be, the journey that it took. But that's really how this paper went from what we were considering initially to be like a short opinion piece or a review piece, like a one or two page article with a commentary, to this really in-depth. It's one of the most exhaustive literature surveys I think I have ever done. And we were quite excited and proud of this work.
Yeah, that's amazing. And COVID definitely altered the way that we all did science. I had an entirely new project that was born out of COVID for the reason we couldn't be in the lab. So yeah, it definitely impacted the way that we worked. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is the first part of this paper, is the introduction. And for those of you that don't know, the introduction, usually I call it like a funnel. So we usually start with a general theme and then we work through down to what the actual study addressed. So Amrita, can you tell us what is the general theme of the paper and what was the big questions that you were trying to address?
Absolutely. So as you already alluded to, the general theme of the paper is looking at antibiotic resistance, which basically means when bacterial pathogens infect human beings, we take antibiotics or other drugs to help us clear the infection. But oftentimes, and I'm sure we've heard this a lot lately, especially these bugs can become resistant to the antibiotics, which means the antibiotics are no longer effective at killing them, which means it can take longer to clear infections or potentially worse consequences in terms of severity of infection. So we were interested in understanding how this sort of, broadly speaking, how antibiotic resistance evolves in these microbes with the goal of understanding if we can figure out what drives this, maybe we can come up with clever ideas to prevent it from happening or slowing it down from happening. So that's the general, like very, very broad interest and field. Now, in this study, the specific thing that really piqued our interest was, even though we hear about drug resistance a lot, and it is genuinely a huge problem for many, many types of pathogens, there still are plenty of examples of cases where any given antibiotic has been used against a specific bacteria to cure it for decades, and it seems to still work perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. Whereas, for example, syphilis, you know, syphilis has been treated with penicillin since 1944, and to date, it's the most effective first-line treatment. There's very little resistance, which is surprising given other things like Staphylococcus is a bacterium, which within 6 years of starting penicillin showed resistance and now has to be treated with other types of antibiotics. So it was this, as evolutionary biologists, we are very intrigued by variation, right? Why is there variation? Mm-hmm. What is driving this variation? So that's really what we got excited about in this question as to, it makes a lot of sense why drug resistance evolves. Like if there's something that's out there trying to kill the bacteria, any variants of the bacteria that are resistant to it will eventually spread because the ones that are getting killed are killed out of competition, and a few mutants that are able to survive in that environment eventually take off. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising that resistance evolves. What was surprising and interesting to us is what is happening in the cases where resistance is not evolving first. How many such cases do we find? And are there factors that are correlated where we can find patterns to say, okay, if a certain bacteria has XYZ characteristics, it may be less likely to evolve resistance or more likely to evolve resistance. So it was like a multi-part question, but I hope mm-hmm. this explanation was clear. What we were trying to understand is why does it happen sometimes and why does it not happen sometimes? Mm-hmm. And are there factors we can identify that can help us understand what is driving this difference?
Yeah, that is an interesting question. And I'm wondering if, because I know there's been so much work done in the field of antibiotic resistance. So were there other studies that you found that tried to address this question in some other way?
That's an excellent question. And that's honestly what we were thinking we would find, and we could compile that information to do an opinion article at first. And so we started by looking at the short answer actually is no, which was surprising. So a lot of what we found is you're absolutely right. There's tons and tons of data and good data looking at cases where drug resistance is a huge problem. So E. coli, Salmonella, like what these are cases, and you can go to, we went to the WHO website, CDC websites, and similar other national organizations in the hopes that we would find a more comprehensive list of pathogens of these bacteria and what amounts of resistance are found. And maybe even we didn't know if the analysis has been done for factors, but we were at least pretty certain or hoping, naively expecting that we would go in and at least find that initial data, which is here are 50 pathogens, and these are the ones where resistance is common, these are the ones where resistance is rare. But to our surprise, what we found is a ton of, which also makes sense because the urgent and most desperate pathogens where we really need new drugs because all of our drugs are failing for resistance are the ones that get a lot of attention. And there's a lot of studies going in to figure out either new drugs or understanding the detailed molecular mechanisms that are driving resistance. But we were very, very surprised to see that the general variation hadn't been characterized at that point. And if the variation itself hadn't been characterized, and we'll get into this more in the methods section, but we had to kind of come up with our own, like I said, we went to CDC and WHO and other websites and we didn't find that. So we had to come up with our own methods to kind of even begin to assess how do we even begin to compare all across all of these different pathogens and see how much resistance exists and then look at factors and gather a lot of data.
So it sounds like a study goal was to just compile information, what you know across the 50, what were they, the 50 most common?
There were 57. So, yeah, so what we did was we first started out by simply taking the latest edition of a standard medical microbiology textbook and just asked the question, what are the most, even not even necessarily the most common, but a medical microbiology textbook that doctors would read in college, what are the human bacterial pathogens? We only focused on bacteria in this case, bacteria and antibiotics. We did not look at fungi or viruses. But all the bacterial pathogens that we could find in that textbook, and also for each of those pathogens, all the different antibiotics that are used to treat them. Like a single pathogen can be treated with different types of antibiotics, which are either in the same class, like penicillins. There are many different types of penicillins, and then there are tetracycline, and there are other drug classes as well. So we started there.
So we're sort of segueing into the methods, but before we do that, can you explain for other people what is the difference between a bacteria and a virus?
Sure. the term I keep referring to this term pathogen. In general, what I mean when I say pathogen is any kind of non-human entity that is infecting a human body and causing disease. In this case, that's how I'm using that term. And now there can be many different types of small, what in colloquial terms we call bugs that cause infections. These
but
could
they're
range
not,
all the way.
They're not really bugs with legs.
They're not really bugs. They're not necessarily insects. They can be insects in some cases, right. But they're not. That's just what we use colloquially. But they can come from many different types of they can be many different types of organisms. So typically, bacteria, fungi, and viruses are they're not the only ones that cause infections, but they're some of the most common ones that we hear about. And bacteria are typically single-celled organisms each individual of that population will be a single cell that can survive on its own and reproduce on its own, and can live independently either inside a human or outside in the environment, or they're basically everywhere. Fungi are slightly more complex. They tend to be multicellular and have specific features that distinguish and separate them from bacteria. And similarly, viruses are another category of microorganisms where I think the most distinct feature that separates viruses from the others is the fact that in order to replicate, the viruses are very, very minimal. They basically just have a protein shell and some genetic material, either DNA or RNA. That's all that a virus will contain outside it's what we would call a host. So in order to be replicating, to reproduce, multiply, and spread, a virus would absolutely need another host body because it uses enzymes and it uses the machinery in the host's body and the host cell to perform its own functions. So there's a lot more we can go into, but yeah. That's like maybe broadly what.
No, that's great. And for public service announcement. We need to make sure that people do understand that antibiotics only treat bacteria. They are not absolutely effective against viruses or other organisms. Exactly. And so that's why some people get really frustrated. Why can't we go if we have the flu and get an antibiotic and feel better? Well, that antibiotic is not going to work against a virus. That's why we need antivirals, which coming back to COVID, you know, they've developed now.
Yes. Absolutely. Okay. That's a very important point. Yes.
Yeah. So moving into the methods section, methods are generally that section of the paper where we talk about specifically what we did and how we did it. And one thing that I run into a lot with my own students is that they're not specific enough. So they, it goes one of two ways. I don't know if you've run into this, but either they're so broad and so general, they don't give enough details that anybody could come in and replicate it, or they are so detailed, it's a click by click sort of protocol. So we try to hit the middle. So in the methods section, I'm wondering, how did you go about collecting the data? And you mentioned that you started with this microbial textbook to identify these 50 pathogens. But what were some of your selection factors there?
Yes. So the first task was to come up with a list, an exhaustive list of bacterial organisms that cause infection in humans. So to do that, and the details, like the name of the textbook and the version, all of that is mentioned in the paper, but we went to this medical microbiology textbook, which had a list of all the bacteria that, which had a list of almost all the bacteria that cause human infections. I want to be careful, like there may be new ones we're still discovering always. So we made a list of those bacteria, and I believe we had 57 different bacteria that we found. And for each bacteria, we also took note of the different antibiotics that are used to treat it. Now, not every bacterium is treated with multiple, or some are treated with just one, some are treated with multiple, but there's preferences. And so we came up with a list. And from that list, we found that we had 53 different antibiotics across all of the different pathogens, right? So it's not every pathogen is not treated with the 53 antibiotics. It's only treated with a few, but across all of the entire list, we had a total of 53 antibiotics. And we found that these 53 antibiotics could be classified, came from broadly clustered groups called drug classes, and there were 15 drug classes. So that was our first, that was our very first step. Like, okay, this is the list for which we need information, right? So now we have all these combinations, bacterium A, drug A, bacterium A, drug B. The next task was to figure out how much resistance, how do we quantify the levels of drug resistance for each of these combinations, right? The same bacteria, there could be one bacteria, which has now become very resistant to one drug, but is not less resistant to another drug. So we wanted to capture that variation, right? Mm-hmm. So this was the tricky part, because this data had to be collected very, very carefully, because this is what the whole rest of the analysis would rest on. And it would be the first time that such an exhaustive list was being developed, you know, this data was being collected. So like I said, we didn't have a ton of success finding this in any of the sources that we had hoped to. So we came up with a couple of methods. So the first thing we did was we just took the bacteria and the 57 pathogens and the different antibiotics, and we had, I believe, 87 or 83 combinations. So for each of those 183 combinations, and quote-unquote experts, so people who were running this study, so me, I had an undergraduate student researcher who was a fantastic collaborator. So what we decided was we came up with a list of criteria. So this is coming to the specific thing that you had said, which were are there cases? So the goal was, the first goal was to broadly characterize them. Is resistance very rare? So hardly seen. And I will explain how we quantified that. Is it rare? Like, it is seen sometimes, but it's not super common. Or is it common? So is it very, like, is it a big problem? So we have on the paper, I cannot go into it. It'll take too long to go into every detail. But yeah, basically, we describe in table one the typical features to assign the combinations into one of these three boxes, right? One of these three categories. So something, for example, that would be a very rare resistance or zero score category would be one where we go onto the internet, we go to the literature, primary literature website, and we look at, we conduct specific searches using keywords with the name of the specific antibiotic and the specific drug. Exactly. Thank you for sharing that screen. Mm-hmm. And we look at all the papers that come out and go through the papers one by one to see what information exists. So we will categorize something as none or very rare if there's very little research gone that has happened. So sometimes we did find cases where there were hardly any papers, or there was one case study in the 90s, one hospital reported one patient who didn't respond to something. So, you know, that's sort of very rare. So wherever it is described, the prevalence of resistance is less than 1%, which means there's fewer than 1% cases where you see resistance. And also often we would find big review articles about that pathogen, right? So like, these pathogens are still interesting and important, and they are still well studied, just not in the context of resistance. But there would be other review articles that would describe these as, these are completely sensitive. They remain fully sensitive too. So this is, as you can tell, it takes a little bit of expertise, and it's definitely somewhat subjective, but there are clear criteria, like there's still a clear criteria that we're using. It's not a number, but it's a category. So similarly, then we went on to rare. These were cases where roughly 1 to 10, we would find papers, not a ton of papers, and the papers would report frequency of resistance to be anywhere between 1 to 10%. So there are cases, but they don't seem to be a huge problem and are not very, very widely discussed. And finally, we put them under the category not rare. So this would be the things you hear about all the time: Salmonella, E. coli, that's not getting treated with the same drugs that we used to treat them with before. So, and there are specific terms that we looked for, like cause for concern, countrywide outbreaks, you know, things like that, in those papers and review articles. So that's how the first method went. Now, this was a good starting point, but even as we were doing this, we were also skeptical, right? This is two people, one postdoc and one undergraduate researcher's opinion. We're experts in the field, but it's our opinion. So we called it the expert review or expert opinion method to figure out how to categorize this. So we were kind of skeptical, and as scientists, we always are. So we wanted to then also come up with a complementary approach. So if you scroll down, the other approach we used was much more specific and much more detailed. And I'll tell you what the caveats are of the two in a bit after I contrast them. So in this case, we took not just the drug classes like penicillin, tetracycline, macrolide, like the broad classes, but we took the very, very specific antibiotic, right? Like, so ciprofloxacin or whatever other, something like that. So we had many, many more combinations now, much more than the 187 that we had for the expert opinion, because now we're looking very, very specifically, and we set very specific criteria that are all included here. And the main difference was to try to get three papers, the three most recent papers that matched a certain level of criteria, like that at least looked at a certain number of samples and, you know, had, they were primary results, they were patient samples, they were not lab strains, they were actually bacteria that we got from patients and things like that. And we wanted to get at a precise number. So we cannot do that for every study for published forever for all these combinations. So we chose in the last 5 years from when the study was being performed, the three most recent papers. So one paper may have calculated 40%, one may have calculated 60%, one may have calculated 50%. We would take the average of those three numbers and use that very specific 53.5% or 22.6%, whatever it came out to be. Now, as you can probably already start imagining, the downside of this, the benefit of this method is we get very precise data, which is always good. But as I had mentioned, cases where resistance is very rare or resistance doesn't happen, these papers don't exist. This mm-hmm. data just doesn't exist. So we did, I forget the exact number, but there were quite a few pathogens and quite a few combinations for which there was straight up no data available, which is why we thought that the combination of having both of these methods and then the downstream analyses and then comparing results across the two methods would give us a robust way of identifying, because if we go for high precision and accuracy in the data, we're running into the same problem that the whole reason why we did this study was because that data didn't exist and we wanted to incorporate. And the fact that the data doesn't exist itself also is information, right? Because mm-hmm. it tells us that there may not be need for it. So the expert review method tries to capture, it's less precise in terms of it only has three blocks, rare, very rare, not rare. And the algorithmic review is more specific and gives us a wider range of resistance, but it also misses a lot of data that the expert review can capture.
So it sounds like what you've done is a typical literature review. And for yes. everybody that doesn't know what that is we go into a particular content topic and we search and scour the peer-reviewed literature that I was discussing earlier for anything on that topic. And then the second part sounds like you were collecting data from all of those different papers to actually reanalyze yes. into a larger data set. We typically use the word meta-analysis for that. It's a broad term that we use to mean that we've taken data from many different papers and then we put them together and try to see the broad general pattern. So I myself have actually written a paper similar to this on a completely different topic. And so I'm curious quickly, and obviously for the general public, they're not probably gonna follow the exact intricate details, yeah, but yeah. can you generally tell me how did you then take this big data set and analyze it?
Absolutely. So now the first step was the list of the pathogens, list of drugs, generating combinations. Mm-hmm. Now, so just picture like a table or a matrix, just a simple Excel sheet or anything you think of, just a table matrix, and it has columns and rows. So we have a column for pathogen, a column for drug, that makes a combination. And then now we had, for each of the two, we had two different sheets, one for the expert method with a score of either 0, 1, 2, one for the algorithmic method with the specific mm-hmm. number. So that yeah. gives us, now the next task was, so that gives us, that's the first part of the question. What is there variation? Yes, there is variation. There are differences in how much resistance we see. Now we wanted to delve into what may be causing this variation. So to understand that, we added 14 more columns. Each column is a specific characteristic of the bacteria itself. So again, there are many, many, like, is the bacteria gram positive, gram negative? We don't need to go into the details, but the idea is to understand how do you get infected by this? Do you collect this? Is it more commonly transmitted in the hospital? You know, or do you need, is it sexually transmitted? What type of features, like for the disease, as well as some are waterborne diseases, airborne diseases, some have animal vectors, some don't have animal vectors, right? So we were collecting all of that information. Similarly, we were also collecting information about the drugs themselves, because it could be something about the drug that's helping resistance or not, and so on. So if you scroll down to the next table, you will see there are, these are the different factors, factor meaning those the additional columns I just described, and they have all been defined, and we either put a yes or no, depending on what we, you know, whatever we found. So I, again, in the interest of time and complication, I will not go into this, but I hope that you get a flavor for what this means. Like some of the common things we hear, for instance, are like, you know, is there hospital transmission. If this is, if you, we've all heard somebody has surgery. My dad recently had surgery. Surgery went well, came home, and 5 days later he was back in the hospital because he had an infection. Mm-hmm. And he picked up that infection during surgery in the hospital, and it was drug resistant, and he had to take very strong antibiotics to help, and spent another 2 weeks in the hospital. You know, so we've all, I feel like at this point, we all have heard or experienced stories like this. So that's, just wanted to use that as an example to give you a sense of what type of factors we were looking at. Once we collected all of this information, we ran some statistical analyses, and I won't go into the details of the analysis itself because that may not be, if anyone's interested, it's there in the paper. But what this analysis is trying to tell us is basically, okay, now you have this much variation across your combinations of drug and pathogen, and we have these 14 factors. Which of these factors are most predictive or associate most strongly with high or low levels of resistance? That's our question, right? So not all of these factors may actually be influencing, or they may all be influencing to some degree. That's why we chose them, because they may all have something to do with resistance. But what this statistical, they were really like long and complex statistical methods where we basically made statistical models that included different factors. Not all, some, one had all of the 14 factors, and some had just one factor, and some had two factors, three factors, so on and so forth. And then we ran statistics and essentially asked statistically, which model with which of these factors explains most of the variation in the data, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then we picked so the so-called best fitting, that's called a best fit model, because this model is, there's X amount of variation. And when we take a model that has these five factors, it explains most of the variation, leaves very little, which means these are the five that are probably really driving the pattern that we see. And then we did some further tweaking to get a ranking and try and understand of these five factors, which one is the most important. So if we remove one factor, how much does it change the fit of the model? If it's a really strong factor that's driving a lot of this variation, removing that from our best model will make the model much worse than if we remove another factor that is explaining less variation, it will reduce the fit only a little bit. Again, it's not important, like these methods have been explained and they do get a little bit complicated. This was the first time I was doing this. I spent a good number of months just learning how to do these analyses and, you know, figuring out what the best analysis, because when we have large data sets, the data is great, but we really need to analyze it carefully to get meaningful insights. So we did that. So we took data from both these methods and tried to come up with models and then looked at the specific factors in the best fitting models to understand how much they were contributing to the variation.
So one quick question. That's something else that I just thought of, is that so many times, you know, we go to get our PhDs and we're specifics in this, you know, we're experts in this very specific field, and we don't always learn all of the skills that we might need later. So what was the process like trying to learn all these statistics that you had not learned previously?
Yeah. Well, when there was a really interesting question and all the data had been collected, there was motivation to really, really understand this. I was like, we really want to figure this out. And so the way I started, I had some help from my advisor who had a strong background in theory and statistical analysis. So he kind of guided me towards the broad, like the model fitting, like we discussed. And then I read a couple of statistical, like, so I knew broadly what I wanted to understand, which is I wanted to understand methods that can develop and compare models to explain this sort of variation. So regression models. So I read up on those from books. And I also, another thing I did was also try to find other studies that were not, they hadn't looked, they necessarily weren't looking at this question, but similar studies, like other meta-analyses or similar studies have been done where people are trying to understand the general thing, whatever their question be, how to get a model that explains most of the variation. So I tried reading some papers like that also to get a sense of what sort of models have been used in the past and how we can accommodate those for our. So one of the methods that I was briefly describing where we find, after finding the best fitting model, we remove one factor from that model and see how much it changes the fit of the model. This is actually something that I found done in another paper. This is less standardized. It's less of it's something that somebody else also facing a similar problem came up with, like, okay, we have these 5 out of 10 factors that seem to be important. Which of these is most important? So they came up with a way to logically and mathematically understand that. So it was a combination of some guidance, some like reading to teach myself from books, as well as reading other peer-reviewed articles that had looked at a completely different topic, but tried to understand, like, do similar statistics.
Very good. Okay, so now I think we're moving into the results. And yes, scientists always get super excited when we can see a graph.
Yes.
So for those of you that are just listening, if you want to look up the paper later, you'll be able to see the graphs that we're going to be discussing. Can you just generally tell me what this figure is trying to tell us? And
absolutely.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, this is the first figure, and this is basically no analysis really has been done. Here you just look at the what we were just the first part of the methods that we described, the first three columns, the drug, the pathogen, and the amount of resistance. So the panels A and B of figure one demonstrate the resistance score. Look at the expert review method. First of all, that's the method here. So remember, we use two different methods for the analysis. And on the x-axis for panel 1A is all of the different, the 57 different bacteria that we looked at. All of those are listed. And on the y-axis is for that bacterium, on average, across all the drugs that were used to treat that bacteria, what was the average resistance score? 0, meaning it's very rare, 2, meaning it's very common, right? So, and then these have all been arranged. So there are some error bars, those lines that you see across some of those. That indicates that for the same bacteria, that same bacteria might be showing very high resistant to some drug and very low resistant to another drug. It's the variation because it's across all the drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so you get this, what this figure does show us though is just, you can see there is such a gradation, right? There's not two blocks. It's not black or white. There's really a lot of variation, even in this very broad kind of categorical method that we use, just three broad categories. You can see that there's a lot of variation again. And same thing we see in panel B, but for panel B, it's the drug classes. There are 15 drug classes, and they're all shown in different colors. And for each drug class, that drug class is used to treat multiple pathogens. So, you know, what is the variation across that? So it's interesting that even for the drugs, even though the same drug can be used to treat so many different pathogens, you see there are some drugs, there is a lot more resistance, and other drugs, there is relatively less resistance. And the panel C and D show us the same thing for the other method, the algorithmic review method. And a couple of things that'll jump out that I want to mention is we kept the order of the pathogens, the x-axis, same for panels A and C. So you can see that for the most part, because we wanted to visually show that the two methods, or even like ask, are the two methods lining up? Or was the subjective, the expert review method totally, like, it gave us more confidence to see that generally there was a low to high pattern in both. right? There are obviously a couple of exceptions towards both ends, and we discussed those specific ones in the paper, but that's just the process of science. It's always messy. It's, mm-hmm. you know, we're used to seeing and expecting very clean data often so in some ways it was quite reassuring to us that yes, there it seems to follow the general trend, but given how widely different these methods were and how many combinations got dropped out, we just wanted to be completely transparent with our audience to say these are the two methods. This is how well they correlate. In some cases, they don't correlate, and we can focus on this. And panel D is, again, the different colors. Again, we use the color mapping so that you could see the different antibiotics in those drug classes have been marked in the same color. So all the pink ones are all different antibiotics specifically. So they're chemically slightly different from each other, but they all belong to the same broad class of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So again,
one thing that really shocked me, and it kind of goes back to what you said earlier, was penicillin. I mean, I really expected, when I first started reading this paper, I really expected penicillin to be down here on this end with a higher level of resistance score, just given the fact that that was our first antibiotic. It's been around for over 60, 70, 80 years?
Years, yeah.
And I really thought that there would be more resistance. So we'll get into it in the discussion. I want to kind of pick your brain about why that might be. But I do see this general trend between the two methods. And I appreciate that level of transparency there. Okay, mm-hmm. So now can you tell us a little bit more about figure three?
Yes, so figure three, basically, it's just a descriptive figure. So like I said, we had those 14 different characteristics that we looked at, bacterial, it's like so zoonosis, if this is animal attained or not, and this just shows us the distribution. Most of these, the ones in black and white, are yes or no categories. Is it nosocomial? So is it transmitted in the hospital? Yes or no? Yes is in the legend will say which ones. Black is yes, white is no, or whatever. And so we just see across. Again, this is just another attempt to show that the data across the two methods is not wildly different, which mm-hmm. gives us more confidence in comparing the two methods and increases our... We use two very different methods to collect resistance data, and we're finding that they're very close to each other in terms of the distribution. So if one method said, you know... And that is not really surprising, because many of these features really depend on the pathogen and not on the drug, so that... You don't expect that to change between the two, right? Like mm-hmm. what you do see, though, another thing you will notice consistently, especially in the top panel, the expert review method, is that the total size of the bar for the ARM, the second method, algorithmic review, is smaller. That's because, like I had said, a lot of combinations were dropped out of that study, of that method, because the data simply mm-hmm. doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So that's also pretty noticeable, clearly noticeable in this case. And and complementary for the lower panel, it looks the opposite, but that is because the total number of combinations were different. For the expert review, mm-hmm. we only use drug class, right? There are only 15 drug mm-hmm. classes. And for the other one, we use specific antibiotics. So we just had a greater number mm-hmm. So that's what's being reflected. And that's why the ERM method has smaller bars, because there's just fewer data points.
Total. Right. And the ERM was that top one, right?
The first one.
The expert review.
Yes.
And then
so three categories, zero, one, two.
Right. And then the ARM was the second logarithmic. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Good. All right. So now we're moving on to figure four, and this is quite a dense figure. So can you just like broadly tell us what is most interesting here?
We don't have to go too much into the details of this, but basically this was, if somebody were to come and say, okay, before doing all that complicated statistics and finding the best model and best factor, all of that, you have all this information. There are 14 different factors. If we forget all the other factors and just look at each characteristic or each factor independently, what does the data look like? And now this is not, so each of these panels is basically telling you, again, these panels represent the two methods for resistance data, ERM and ARM. And you can see, like, nosocomial, that word basically means if a pathogen is transmitted in the hospital setting or not. So it's a yes or no question. And so you can see that for the expert review method, we find that those pathogens which are transmitted, which are a yes for nosocomial, which means patients can pick it up in the hospital, have significantly higher levels of resistance than those pathogens that don't. That's what mm-hmm. that figure is showing. Right. And there are many others where we didn't find any significant difference when we were. So these are what we just call a single factor analysis. We are not accounting for any of the other factors. We're simply asking, here's our variation, here's this one factor. When you group them into yes or no, are the two categories significantly different?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're basically, yeah. So we found some indications. And again, I feel like if we can go in depth, but this may get overwhelming to go yeah. through all of those. But we found, so we were reassured to find that the factor of hospital transmission showed up as a significant factor in both the ERM and the ARM data, because that is one thing that previous studies have often up, even though those studies haven't done exactly what we have done, but when studies look at pathogens with really high resistance, they do find that it's very, very commonly observed in hospital settings.
Yes. And that brings me a little bit, and I think we can maybe skip over this. I really want to get yes. into the discussion.
Yes, we could probably go to that last table that we have.
Oops, sorry.
Where we summarize everything in the
last table.
In table two or table three, I believe. Let's
okay.
Like all of the Here. Results.
Table two. Is this it?
Yep, this can help. Yep, this would help.
So it looks like, so for those of you that are able to see the table, the ones that are in bold were significant. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So hospital transmission and zoonosis, which is basically animal. And then can you tell me, what did you mean by commensal?
Yes. Commensal means bacteria that are part of our human microbiome. So I think this is a term we have often heard. So even though, even when we are not sick and don't have an infection, we have a lot of bacteria in our body that help us really do our day-to-day functions. We have a lot of bacteria in our gut. We have a lot of bacteria on our skin that actually live in harmony with us and often could even help us. And it's a commensal relationship where they're not harming us, we're not harming them, but we both coexist together. So sometimes though, there are bacteria that are in our stomach that are great, that help, that do the right thing in the stomach. But if for some reason that bacterium from the stomach gets dislodged and gets into our blood, it can cause there can be bad effects of that, because our blood is not supposed to have any bacteria. So sometimes certain infections can be caused even by pathogens that are otherwise not harmful to us when they're in their right location in our body, but they can get translocated and cause infection or problems in other parts of our body. Similarly, the other issue is sometimes we're getting treated for, you know, when we get treated and take antibiotics, we will take the antibiotic orally, take a tablet or a pill for 5 days or 10 days, whatever the doctor suggests, right? So that is then going into our bloodstream and going into all of our organs, right? Mm-hmm. And it's killing the specific pathogen that it's supposed to, but it is also, the drug is also getting seen by the bacteria that are in our microbiome, right? The stomach bacteria that are happy and not hurting us, but they are also getting affected by the antibiotic that we consume. So sometimes recent studies, lots of studies have looked at this and shown that our own bacteria can evolve resistance to the drugs that we're taking to cure, treat other, which is another important reason why doctors really don't want to, you know, for viral infections, fungal, it really can end up doing more long-term harm than good if we take antibiotics when they're not necessary, because they're not killing anything. The infection is still the same, but our good bacteria are getting killed. And that sometimes imposes selection. So the problem is sometimes even we just become carriers. So we're just carrying these bacteria that are in our stomach. And in the stomach, it doesn't matter that they're resistant or not resistant. But if for some reason they get dislodged and cause an infection, say in the urinary tract or cause a blood infection, then that infection becomes harder to cure or treat, because now, from a previous time, our own bacteria due to antibiotic usage may have become resistant. So that's why we wanted to look at.
Okay, very good. And so it seems like that and naturally competent, what does that mean?
So natural competence is basically the ability. It's a bacterial characteristic. If a bacteria is naturally competent, that means that bacteria can absorb DNA or other genetic material from its environment. Okay, so this is one way in which even the bacteria are in the bacterial individuals are single celled, and you know, they just reproduce. They don't have two parents that produce an offspring. It's the same cell that divides into 2, 4, 8. Sometimes it can rupture, and release its DNA into the environment. Let's say it's in water, and then there's another cell of a different bacterium that can take it up. Mm-hmm. So this is broadly, we call this and other, there are a couple of other methods, conjugation, the one listed right after that is another. So these are slightly different mechanisms for, but the basic idea is where bacteria can exchange genetic material with each other.
Right.
So there can be different methods of doing that. Yeah.
As we learned in Kurt's lab, genetic diversity is important, and bacteria don't really have sex the way that multicellular animals do, but getting that genetic diversity is important. And so these are two different mechanisms by which bacteria mm-hmm. can do that. So yes. It seems like increasing your genetic diversity as well as transmission method by which you actually get that infection are the most important factors that are really coming out here. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And that is not surprising, because the same way that you're increasing genetic diversity, like you just said, Deanna, if one bacteria's genetics has a drug-resistant mutation and that gene now gets absorbed by a bacterium that previously did not, now that becomes resistant also. Even though there was no treatment, there was no, you know, the human being didn't take that antibiotic, it's just getting horizontally transmitted. So yeah, so these are some, and you can see they're slightly different between the two different methods. And the numbers, they're really not that important. They just tell us the direction, like if the correlation is positive, if it's a positive number, it means that this factor, if you have this factor, there is the likelihood of drug resistance is higher. And a negative number, like for zoonosis just means that, like an example would be Lyme disease, where the bacterium goes through deer, goes through ticks, and then the tick bites us and we get the infections. So it's spending time in other hosts that are not human, and it's not going from, I cannot give Lyme disease to my friend. My friend has to get bit by a tick that was in a deer. So it's going through the animals. So what we find is in the cases where those go through the animals, the association is the opposite, which is those animals, those drugs, those pathogens seem to have less resistance. Mm-hmm. And at first this would seem surprising, but you know, take that example of Lyme disease. We think that the reason this is happening is because I may get Lyme disease and the doctor may treat me with the drug for Lyme disease, even if inside my body, the pathogen, after I'm being treated with the drug, it becomes resistant, it evolves resistance. I am no longer able to pass that that bacteria to another human being. That other human being still has to get infected or does get infected with a bacterium that came from the tick that came from the deer. And the deer are not being given the same drug.
Right.
Or the ticks are not being given the same drug. So that's how they're not getting. So we think that also makes sense. And we did not see this effect in the other method, but that was because many of these pathogens, again, like Lyme disease, which have very little resistance, dropped out of the other analysis. So we couldn't find, the data just wasn't there.
And that brings me to, I think, the next section, which is the discussion section. And in here, I'm going to stop sharing because it's really discussion. So, so I think you've done a pretty good job of summarizing the results, but how do you think that your results really compare to other papers that have been published in the field?
Yes, that's a great, great question. So, even though our study, as I said in the introduction, in itself, the question we were asking, we still believe we were the first people to ask that, and it took a lot of work to be understood. When we started doing it, we realized why nobody else had done it, because it wasn't, and we only could do it because it was COVID and we were all sitting at home, and this was an amazing project to give, to devote attention to at the time. Having said that, that doesn't mean that we didn't have any idea going in what factors may be associated with resistance. So what, in the ideal scenario, so we think our results actually ended up confirming some things or agreeing with some things that have already been found in the literature, and also providing some novel insights that need to be followed up and further validated, of course, because one study is never enough to confirm something. So the first thing that we found, or one of the things that we found that was really consistent with what other studies have shown, is that transmission in hospital environments is associated with a very high level of resistance. So, and that makes a lot of sense. And this has been studied in great depths, and there are lots of programs at the state level, national level, global level that are trying to, attack this problem and trying to improve sanitation methods and improve hospital practices to somewhat minimize the rate at which the likelihood that somebody gets an infection in a hospital setting. It's not surprising because previous studies have shown this. In a hospital environment, there are lots of sick patients. They have all got different types of bacteria. They're all being treated, presumably, with really high quantity. You know, if patients are in a hospital when they're really, really sick and need really, really high doses of treatment, all of which can promote or further select for highly resistant pathogens. And then all of these different pathogens and all of these different patients are all relatively concentrated, right? Like if in your home, if you are sick, you're not around as many people who are also likely to be sick with the same bacteria or a different bacteria that has drug resistance, right? But that chance is much, much higher. So surgical instruments, simply just things, airborne diseases can, just the likelihood that there is a lot of drug, so there's a lot of selection, and there's also a lot of opportunity for transmission. So that is why and that was the biggest predictive factor that dropped out of our analysis too. So that's not surprising, not new. If anything, we were very happy that both of our methods showed that, because that was almost a proof of concept for us.
Right.
Some other things that we found that had not been shown before. One of those is the animal, the zoonosis factor that I briefly discussed when we were looking at the results. And of course, each of those has been individually studied, like Lyme disease has been studied, anthrax has been studied. But because drug resistance is not a huge problem in those cases, we don't often, you know, that's why we don't find that data in the algorithmic review method. And this, to my knowledge, was the first time we looked at all of those bacteria all together, compared them with bacteria that are not being transmitted in animals, and were able to show this striking difference, indicating that there may be something going on, which doesn't mean we shouldn't take those pathogens seriously, but it's giving us an idea of what could be driving. Again, less exposure to drugs and less exposure. Another thing we found, and I think these are the three most important highlights of the results we found. So the other factor we found was just the method of transmission itself, if we broadly categorize that as direct. So direct transmission would be sexually transmitted diseases where you need direct contact, or you know, or something where it could be airborne, but it's like you have to be very, very close to the person. You cannot sneeze in a mall and somebody else walks by 5 minutes later and picks up the same bug. Like you have to really, it can be spread by touch or kiss or things like that. So those pathogens we found, when they're directly transmitted, they seem to be associated with less resistance. And the ones that are indirectly transmitted, so ones that are waterborne, right? Cholera is waterborne. One person goes and, like, you know, if there's a fail in sanitation practices, people sharing the same drinking water can all get infected. We knew about typhoid Mary is a good example where this one person who is sick but not symptomatic can be preparing food for a lot of people and accidentally infecting them. So things like that tend to show a higher level of resistance. And to our best knowledge, this was the first time, again, a study had really found this difference, primarily, I think, because we had the power in our analysis to compare enough bacteria of each type and their resistance to look at.
That is so interesting. And of course, Amrita keeps referring to the fact that we've known some of this, the importance of transmission for a long time. And it was during COVID or right after we, you know, went back into the classroom with it, which at UD was actually the fall of 2020. People were hypothesizing that we were trying to control them by doing the shutdown. And one thing that I tried to show my students is this has been known for a really long time in science, going back to Anderson and May's work in the 1970s. We know that transmission can actually impact resistance. It can change how sick something makes you because of the process of evolution and respiratory diseases, as you've been discussing, this indirect respiratory, which is what COVID is. I mean, they were reporting, especially with that alpha strain, you would be able to sneeze and then someone could come into the room 5 minutes later and get infected because the particles are still floating in the air.
Yeah,
I mean, the minute that I knew that and that there was asymptomatic transmission, I was like, we are in serious trouble.
Trouble, exactly.
And one way that Anderson and May early on in the 1970s found to help to ramp down not only how sick something makes you, but also just to provide general population level resistance is to alter and reduce transmission. And so that is something that it's very interesting that your study really kind of fits into that model framework that's been around since the mid-1900s.
Definitely. And like, even though they talk just about disease transmission and, you know, infection rates and things like that, it still holds. The same principle seems to hold even when you're, because the only thing that's changing is whatever can increase the likelihood of a resistant bacteria to spread is going to increase the problem of antibiotic resistance. Yeah, I did want to like slightly, that wasn't in the context of drug resistance per se, but it's not surprising. It's just that the agent causing the infection now is something. So there are two factors. One is factors that can enable resistance to evolve in the first place, and then factors that can enable or support the spread of that. There are two things that need to happen for drug resistance to become a problem. One is it has to evolve in the first place. And second is it has to then, after evolving, if like with the Lyme disease example, it can evolve if you're giving it to a patient and then you may have to change the drug for that patient, but the transmission is blocked so it doesn't become a huge problem.
Right.
And on the other hand, there may be other cases where there's just something really special in the bacteria, like which has been found in syphilis. There's a very specific type of molecular mechanism, which is why it just doesn't evolve in the first place, even though it transmits from person to person. So both of those factors, but transmission is absolutely, this definitely ties back to a lot of classic literature that expresses the importance of transmission in disease.
So one final question, and I'm going to end with a question that yes. Kurt, and for those of you that didn't pick up on it, but Amrita and I shared the same PhD advisor. He would end not all, but many meetings, or sometimes he'd have a whole meeting about this. So my last question is, what are your biggest unanswered questions in the field of medical microbiology?
That's a really fascinating question. So I think even though a lot of my work, besides the obvious, which are these questions about drug resistance and just how and evolutionary medicine in general, like just understanding, gaining insights into evolutionary processes that drive disease, infection, transmission, and how we can use those to curb, to treat. And that's been something that's been just a broad topic that I've been very interested in. But more recently, I've been really fascinated to understand one of the new treatments that's coming onto the market these days is what's called microbiome therapeutics, which is the idea that you take good bacteria from your own body and use those as drugs. It's in fact even one way that is being proposed to counter drug resistance issues. Like you don't use a chemical drug anymore. You make the good bacteria fight the bad bacteria and win out and you know, use bacteria against bacteria. And as somebody who's been really fascinated by microbial social interactions, I'm really excited both about the possibility of that and also understanding what could be the evolutionary implications of that. So could there be a possibility of those interactions evolving in a way that resistance can become a possibility even with microbial drugs, right? Mm-hmm. So the microbe is potentially making a toxin or making something, some kind of substance that's killing your bad bacteria. And how do we use that, or will our infectious pathogens, you know, in the arms race kind of come back out on top again saying, oh, now I can fight you better. And like, we'll see a whole new interaction evolving.
That sounds like a far-out answer.
So. Yeah, but that's the sort of thing. It's, you know, even though these things do seem far out, there's literally an FDA-approved drug to treat Clostridium infections in humans that are.
Yeah, the C. diff, right? Where you can take the pill that is basically somebody else's poop, and then it actually seeds your intestines.
Gut with that, your intestines with the right bacteria to fight it off. Yeah, and so far there were experimental treatments, but I think there's one company that just last year got FDA approved. And the difference here is they pick specific ones. It's not just like a slurry of good patient bacteria. It's like very specific. They're not engineered, but they're specifically picked and composed into a pill. And so now it's no longer like a whole sort of, you know, like a hospital procedure or anything. It's just like any other pill you take.
So that's amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Bhatichara. And we are going to end the podcast with saying, when science talks, we listen. See you next time.